for a better way.
Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, April the 18th, 2024. This is episode 3,482 of the Survival Podcast. And today, of course, being a Thursday, it's time for an expert council Q&A show for the week. And I've got a big lineup of experts for you today. By adding some new members to the council and shaking the piker tree and a few other things, we were able to get a good deep show today with a lot of variation. Here's what we have for you today. Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams will talk about how the new police powers in the FISA bill in Section 702 are shocking. And there is no exaggeration in what they have to say, but I'll leave it to them and explain it to you. Ken Berry's going to talk about how fasting can aid with what most people call insulin resistance, but it's why it's actually a different problem. And so Ken will cover that. Andy McCann will talk about building up your leg and knee endurance when you already have a knee issue. And you're kind of a guy that likes to go well out into the backcountry, but you're having some knee issues and you're afraid you're going to end up stuck there. How about repurposing a small off-grid RV solar system? When you ain't living off-grid in an RV no more, now you done got responsible, got yourself a wife and a house, and the solar panels don't really make enough power for the batteries, but you have it and you'd like it to help with your... What do you do? Well, Sean Mills has some advice on that. And then, have you ever heard of a LifeVac? LifeVac. It's designed in case you have an airway obstruction. Somebody wanted to know Doc Bones' opinion on that. Is it worth having? He'll talk about that. And Nick Ferguson will talk about willow fodder for rabbits in a way we've never talked about it before. Can it be dangerous for rabbits? Basically, it has the root ingredient of aspirin in it. And, of course, you can overdose on aspirin. In fact, if you wanted to overdose somebody intentionally on something really easy to get your hands on and not only have them die, but have it to be a horrible, painful death, aspirin would be the way to do it. It will eventually thin blood enough that you will start to bleed out everywhere in your body all at the same time. Basically, non-fever-based hemorrhagic fever. So you would think that maybe this could be a problem. Well, it kind of, sort of can, but anybody doing it to the point where it would be a problem would probably create a problem no matter what they were feeding their rabbits or any being or creature, because nothing should eat only one thing unless it's a specialized thing that only eats one thing. So we'll talk about that. And then we're going to talk in my segment about ways to cook and use winter squash. A fellow wrote in and said they've knocked a lot of starches out of their life through eating lower carb. Doesn't sound like they've gone full tilt bore with it, but hey, you know, cutting down the amount of sugar in your diet, which all carbohydrates are, is a good thing. And there's plenty of people out there, like I've said all the time, I might stay really, really low on carb intake because I kind of need to for a couple reasons. One's just my genetic makeup. I react really strongly to carbs, but two is I lived a lot of my life eating way too much carbohydrate. And I think you can jack up your metabolism to where even though you get healthy, maybe you never get back what you had when you were 25. But there's a lot of people out there, if they cut their carb intake somewhere between 75 and 100 carbs a day, and I'm talking total, not net at that point. Again, with net, you can trust broccoli, but you can't trust all these products and things that are supposedly made with resistant starch. So with that in mind, I'm saying 75 to 100 carbohydrates a day will work really great for a lot of people. And that really opens up the door for winter squashes and a lot of other vegetables. And winter squash is something I really like. I don't eat a ton of it because it still is a carb-based thing, but you know, it is kind of one of my comfort foods now. And I have a lot of ways that I use it. And I use it a lot more, ironically, in winter than summer, but I do have some things that will help this guy and a couple different ways that you can start utilizing squashes like Trombonchino, butternut, acorn, etc. And the thing is, it works with all of them. In fact, all of the things will work with all of them. You can pretty much treat them all the same, even though they definitely have some differences in taste and flavor. Before we get into today's episode, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor day number one today is KnifeKits.com, guys. I'll tell you what, you definitely want to check out KnifeKits.com if you never have before. It's exactly what it is. You know, it says exactly what it is and does exactly what it says. Knife kits. It gives you the ability to start making your own knives right out of the gate, even if you've never done it before. You buy basically a completed frame and the scales, and maybe pick out some handle material if you want to do it custom, maybe some pins and things like that. But everything's pretty much ready to be assembled, put together, finished, and sharpened. And you can do that. Or you can get raw materials and you can take things up at another level. You can, you know, forge, you know, do your own metal removal, shaping or forging or whatever with the steel that they provide you. They also have everything you need for, you know, making holsters and sheaths, both out of kydex and leather and a lot of other cool stuff. And they do a discount for MSB members, and they have been the most loyal sponsor that a podcast could ever have. They signed up to sponsor this show in 2009. It is 2024 and they are still here. They were not the first sponsor, but they are the longest-running continuous sponsor that we have, and that says an awful lot about them and their support of this show. So definitely think about, you know, build an heirloom with your kid, because that's one of the things you can do starting with KnifeKits.com. Next, real quick, want to remind you that you should come on down to Bastrop, Texas next month for the Exit and Build Land Summit. This is the fourth one that John Bush has done. It's the fourth one that I've spoken at. This is my busiest time of year. I do not like to travel much at all, but I really don't like to travel in spring. John makes it easy for me because it's only 3.5 hours to get down there. I'm still gone for 4 days, but yet I'm there every time. Why? He does a fantastic job. The people I meet are incredible. It is an incredible event, and it's not just the event itself. It's the stuff around it. You should check into it. You should think about getting there a day early or staying an extra day for some of the farm tours, getting a VIP pass, all of that. Again, it is really, really just an excellent event, and it is called Exit and Build from Live Free Academy. There's a link in today's show notes, and there is a banner on the Survival Podcast website for all the sponsors. And with that, let's go ahead and hear from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams about this new FISA bill, which is really awful.
But the headline tells us a little bit about where we're going, and that is, this is from Zero Head, supercharged spying provision buried in terrifying FISA 702 reauthorization. I guess it shouldn't shock us that there's something in there.
It was already
so bad. But this discovery has nothing to do with providing more national defense. Matter of fact, it has everything to do with undermining, you know, liberty and defense, because it's such an atrocious attack on personal liberties.
And remember what Johnson said. He said, well, when I was on judiciary, there were thousands and thousands of abuses by the FBI. But now that I'm speaker, I got a classified briefing, and I'm all for it. So it shows that he's either criminally naive about this whole thing, in which case he shouldn't be the speaker, shouldn't even be in Congress, or he's in on it. He's one of them. He's against America. And it's terrible. Let's put that first clip up. Because buried in the bill, HPSC, the House, the Select Intelligence Committee, put some things in it, put an amendment to this bill that made it incredibly worse. It said, here's the hedge opener. On Monday, House finalized procedural business on a bill to reauthorize the nation's warrantless surveillance powers under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which Ron Wyden called one of the most dramatic and terrifying expansions of government surveillance authority in history. I will do everything in my power to stop it from passing the Senate, said Senator Wyden. Now, we've worked with Wyden in the past. He's been very good on civil liberties, and he's got a keen eye for these things.
That if you have access to any communications, the government can force you to help it spy. That means anybody with access to a server, a wire, a cable box, a Wi-Fi router, a phone, or a computer. So think for a moment about the millions of Americans who work in buildings and offices in which communications are stored or passed through. After all, every office building in America has data cables running through it. And the people are not just the engineers who install, maintain, and repair our communications infrastructure. There are countless others who could be forced to help the government spy, including those who clean offices and guard buildings. If this provision is enacted, the government can deputize any of these people against their will and force them, in effect, to become what amounts to an agent for Big Brother. For example, by forcing an employee to insert a USB thumb drive into a server at an office they clean or guard at night. This can all happen without any oversight whatsoever. The FISA court won't know about it. The Congress won't know about it. Americans who are handed these directives will be forbidden from talking about it.
So that's just incredible. The person who cleans the building at night can be forced to insert a thumb drive and download all the data of an employee, and that he or she cannot tell anyone about it, and the government will force them to spy on Americans. I can't believe it.
When I was listening to this and reading what's going on, I keep thinking back to our first experience with this type of issue, and my comment to myself was, it all started with the Patriot Act.
It sure did. Well, you remember what they did during the Patriot Act, or the Patriot Act time. They said, we're at war, Ron. This is no time to be whining about civil liberties.
That's how
they rammed it through. We're at war.
If this stands, this is a tremendous victory for the police state.
Yes.
And so often in past times, people would say, how did the people go along with this? Why did they do it? There were a lot of good people in Japan and Germany and Italy and all these places, and yet they still went along with it. But here's an example of it. They don't keep their guard up, and they're taught to be obedient to anything that sounds like patriotism, and they go along with it.
What this instantly made me think of, and I want to say something about the show that I'm about to mention here. It was not the best done show, and they weren't really adherent to good research. It was an entertaining show, and there was some stupid shit in it, and I want to talk about the stupid shit before I talk about the episode that got pulled and memory hold because of how accurate it was. So, for instance, Jesse Ventura and his people did a episode on the probably the most famous conspiracy of all time, who killed JFK. And they took a scissor lift style lift and used it to simulate the altitude of the books depository building window that Oswald supposedly shot Kennedy out of. And they went up there and they're talking about, first of all, could you make the shot? Not could you hit Kennedy, but could you make the shot and cause it to do what the supposed single bullet did? And, well, that would not be scientific at all, because you wouldn't be doing that. You would try to hit Kennedy, and if that happened, it happened, and bullets do weird shit. And you guys all know me. I really don't believe the official story about Kennedy. I told you a few months ago there was a documentary that came out that I'm now not interested in anymore, because I'm so convinced that we now know what happened and we've known since the 70s, and no one wants to talk about it because it's not all sexy. But that was dumb, and one of the dumbest things in it was Jesse said he had the rifle and he was up there seeing if he could do it, and he said, I was up there trying to see if I could make that shot, and everything was moving all over the place. Because you're on a scissor lift outside, you dipshit! Just so that when I say this, you don't think I'm saying that everything about this show is great, okay? But in his show, Conspiracy Theory with Jesse Ventura, they did one on the deep state, and the spying on Americans by Americans, and how these government alphabet agencies recruit people and would do things like implant bugs and shit in the office of a dentist who thought he was helping. And they were collecting data on people, because when people go into a doctor's office, a dentist's office, they open up about things, right? Especially when they're under anesthesia or whatever. Well, that show came out, and it didn't just get memory hold disappeared like it never happened. There were plenty of people who said, I had this show on my DVR to watch it later, and not anything except this one episode disappeared. And all I think you see with this new authorization is a way to expand that type of activity that's been going on for a very, very, very long time, at least since the 60s and 70s. And I think there's a lot of evidence for it. And what you're seeing is so typical. So people think, well, like, they're just becoming more aggressive or whatever. But there's always a reason for everybody to do everything. And I always try to caution people not to try to go to the extreme just for the purpose of the extreme, but to analyze things and look for patterns. Every empire that gets toward the end of its existence does the same thing. Instead of fixing the problems that are causing misery for the empire and causing it to fall, the people in power seek to maintain power over the people within the empire. So instead of addressing the cause, they seek power. It's another way of looking at Jerry Pournelle's Iron Law of Bureaucracy, right? They're dedicated to the organization itself rather than the mission. And that's what you see here. How do we maintain control when we know everything's falling apart? It is a very dangerous time to stand up for what's right when this is going on in empire. I encourage you to do it anyway, and I'm going to keep doing it myself. Let's go on to something totally different, except it is the same because the reason we have the problem is the same people that are in power. But let's talk about insulin resistance and what it really is and how we can address it. Keto, carnivore, but specifically in this case, fasting.
Hello, Jack and the TSP crew. Dr. Ken Berry here today answering a question for Stan from Missouri. Could you talk about how fasting, liquid fasting, several days could help reduce insulin resistance? So first and foremost, the term insulin resistance is quite misleading. The vast majority of people are hyperinsulinemic, meaning their insulin level is just chronically too high. Some people talk about this and they use the term insulin resistance, but that's not really a real thing. It's just a construct we use to talk about a syndrome of symptoms. The thing you want to focus on is hyperinsulinemia, and the way you measure that is to check fasting insulin. Now, Stan goes on to give me some labs, which are kind of hard to read here. A1C 6.9. You don't tell me what diet you've been eating. I don't see where you mentioned that. But if it's keto, oh, I see. Okay, carnivore for 3 weeks, yes. So you definitely need to be a strict carnivore, beef, butter, bacon, and eggs, to get that A1C down further. And I don't see where you've had a fasting insulin checked. I don't know if you're hyperinsulinemic or not. Your triglycerides are 104, which is good. Your HDL is 48, which is not bad. Stop worrying about being insulin resistant. Go carnivore, get your A1C down to normal, and check a fasting insulin along with your A1C every 3 months. And that's going to give you a clear picture of how your metabolic health is doing. Thanks a lot, guys. Talk to you next time.
All right, good stuff from Ken as always, and I really encourage those of you who need to improve your health to consider taking this carnivore and or keto approach. When you start looking at A1Cs that are 6 and higher, you're talking about people that are on the way to losing fingers, toes, and kidneys, okay? And some of you folks are in the 7s, and you got companies selling drugs that are making like it's a good thing if you can get your A1C under 7. Under 7 is 6.9, and you're killing yourself. Chronic disease epidemic of our lifetime. It really is. This is our, polio. Or this is our smallpox. The difference is, those required significant advances in medicine to address. I know some of you don't think so, but, well, that's fine. You can think whatever you want. Those required significant advances in medicine to address. Smallpox in particular killed tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of people across centuries. The only thing we need to do to address this chronic epidemic is stop eating garbage. So please think about it. The other thing is, while I was listening to that multitasking, I thought about what I said about Jesse Ventura's episode on the deep state being memory hold, and did a little research because I couldn't remember what it was called, what season it was. It was the fourth episode in the first season, and it was called Big Brother. Well, you know how the internet works. Nothing's gone forever, and we have platforms like BitChute and what have you. And I will also say BitChute has some batshit crazy nonsensical, you know, pseudo documentaries and shit like that on there. But somebody somewhere who did record this then converted it to digital and uploaded it to BitChute. This episode's from 2009, so it's been around a while. And you can find it if you want to, because a lot of times when they memory hole things, they know if they just keep the chatter down while the thing's new, it becomes an old thing nobody cares about anymore, because people have the attention span of a beer bottle with a peeling label in the United States today. But if you don't, if you have a real attention span and you want to know how the segment you just listened to prior to this last one from Ron Paul and Dan McAdams relates to what's already been going on now for many years, and certainly going back with Jesse's little documentary there, over 10, you can find that in the show notes today. Let's move on. Again, sticking with the practical. What do you do if you have a knee that keeps popping out, and you also are a person that likes to, you know, backpack in to hunt and lugging heavy gear and all, and you love to do that, but you're afraid you could end up, you know, laying on your ass in the valley somewhere with a satellite button trip waiting to be excavated because you're stuck. And so you want to build up Viking legs. I don't know if you need Viking legs, but I do know that Andy McCann can help with this, so I sent this one off to him.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann with CrossFit Garage coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia. And Jay has a question, and he is from somewhere with mountains. And he says, how do I build massive Viking endurance legs at 50 with one iffy knee? Yeah, I love that. I'm not sure exactly what a Viking leg is, but I love that. So details. One iffy knee has dislocated a few times in my life. Last was just a couple years ago. I like to hike and hunt at altitude, and I only need to get there, but hauling a 100-pound pack worries me. I've done this before 7 years ago, but it feels like I need to protect my knee with as much muscle as possible. I have a pro-quality treadmill. I use every morning 3 miles at 10-degree inclination or 10-degree incline at about 3.5 miles per hour. I have dumbbells in pairs from 10 pounds up to 55 pounds, no plates or barbells, and I'm rural. Thanks. Okay, so, Jay, I think what I'm hearing you say is I want to go out and do something fun, and my knee may hold me back. So what I'm really going to say is toss money at it. So go get a really good brace and wear it, make sure it feels good, and see if your leg's going to dislocate. So the question was, how do I make sure this I get these Viking legs because I am fearful of this iffy knee? So I'm going to take it in two parts. If you're fearful of the knee, then one, yeah, let's brace it up. Two, maybe hire a Sherpa, hire a teenager, or get somebody to go with you that's going to carry all that stuff, because 100 pounds at altitude, man, dude, that's a lot. You may be asking too much of yourself, but put a brace on it. Okay, so then you said, hey, how can I build up muscle around my knee? So knee isn't necessarily like muscular. You can actually do too much muscle and then have like your quad pulling your kneecap in a different direction. So you want to really go at this in a very steady build. So I do love that you're on a treadmill. I would get off the treadmill and go out in real life. So a weird thing about a treadmill is you're going to pick your foot up and put it forward, but the treadmill is going to push it back for you. So you aren't going to do the exact same amount of work. I mean, it's better than nothing. Good for you. Glad you're doing it. But I would up it and do something out in your rural community, right? So put a backpack on and start walking and see how that feels. Okay, so things that I know you can do to strengthen up your knee that doesn't require surgery or seeing a doctor is you can do this thing called karaoke or grapevine. Call it whatever it is. And you basically move your leg back and forth as you shuffle, like right or left. Google that, type in CrossFit grapevine, and it should come up. Maybe come up anywhere if you go on YouTube, but it's either karaoke or grapevine. So I would look into that. I know a guy over in Buford High School over in Suwannee, and he would rehab his athletes who would go through MCL, ACL tear surgery and so forth by doing a lot of this and other stuff, but it was a huge component of it. So it sounds like if your knee is dislocating, you probably have a tear that you don't know about, or maybe a ligament like is just not there or is losing ability as you get older or something, right? So we want to make sure that knee stays together. Will muscle help? Sure, But it depends on how it's dislocating, hence going with the brace. So I've got some recommendations. I'll put them in the show notes so Jack can talk to you guys about it. I will take the biggest one you can get and wear it around so that you can not get rubs and raw from just the way it feels. Okay, so the other one, I've mentioned this before, or maybe in the timeline, this your question comes out first, but I love the Knees Over Toe Guy. You can find him on YouTube at the Knees Over Toe Guy. He's got his own website, the ATG. It's Athletic Truth Group, and he goes through a whole lot of stuff about knees. You can do it easy. Just you can find his PDF and just follow it. I would pay him the money. It's really good stuff. I've done it. You can even go one step further and get one of his coaches to actually help you. So if you really want to shortcut the process, hire a coach or mentor. Just pay him, and they'll have you do exercises. You can send them videos, but it's all about your knee. It's good stuff. I got a video here that I pulled up for Grapevine, so you can definitely follow it on Facebook, YouTube. And then there's something else you can do, Google or YouTube, squat CrossFit and squat therapy, and you're going to see what a good squat looks like. So if you're doing these things, you're going to build up the muscle and such around your knee correctly. If you're just doing a treadmill, you're probably going down a road that's not exactly what you want. That's good for your endurance, but it's not really going to go for your knee. So your question, specifically your question was, how do I build massive Viking endurance legs at 50 with an iffy knee? So there's, like I said, there's a lot of things that go in that. You don't necessarily need a ton of muscle. That's just going to be more stuff you're lugging around. You can recruit more muscle fiber, and that's where intensity kind of comes into play. So if you do workouts with hypertrophy, then you're growing the muscle fiber. Not maybe exactly what you want. So what I would use those dumbbells, I would take them and do weighted squats. Look at squat therapy, see what they're doing. You could also turn it into a thruster. It's basically a squat, and then you stand up and then put the bar or the dumbbells above your head. And you could use the various weights and see how you're feeling. Again, in all this, make sure you're paying attention to your knee, especially when you go out walking with a backpack or rucking, as they would call it. Understand what's happening to your knee. When and where does it feel like it's dislocating? Really understand that. Get some knee braces. Try a couple out. I really like the super aggressive one. Let me find that. So it's the one that I pulled up is, let me see. Actually, I'll just send it to Jack and he can tag it. But it's pretty aggressive if you look at it. It's got metal. It's got padding. It's got a Velcro in the top and the bottom, so it's going to keep you very secure. If you also want to build that endurance without really messing with your knee, get some sort of Rogue Echo bike or an assault bike. You can get off of Amazon. I'll link that too for Jack to show you guys. So here's the thing. If you want to build up that endurance to be able to lug, you need to sort of participate in that sort of movement. So I know you can't maybe replicate elevation, but you can replicate some of the distance and then maybe double it. Also, you can add weight. Also, you can add some intensity. So you want to be doing the movement that you're going to be out there doing and then a little bit more. So I would go aggressive on the squats to make sure that you're building the knee with stability. I'd go aggressive on the karaoke or tapioca or grapevine, whatever it's called, going back and forth. And again, take those dumbbells that you already have. You could walk with some in your hands. I'm not a huge fan of that. It's kind of heck on your shoulders. I'd rather put a backpack on. But you have them, so use them, right? If you can take a video and send it to me, andy@crossfitgarage.com, let me see what your squat looks like. If your knees are traveling in, then that's a totally different problem, and I'd have to do another session on just that. All right, hope that helps. Y'all take care. You can find me at on YouTube, at andymccann42, or you can get on my podcast, which is CrossFit Garage. You can find it on any of the podcast delivery services.
He's going to tell you the grapevine is a dance step. It's pretty easy to do. It is a good fitness tool as well. And I don't remember what we call it. We used to do it all the time in football. It was just part of one of the many, many grass drills that we did when I used to play football. But good advice there. I do have Andy's links for how to do the grapevine, the squat therapy video, the assault air bike link, along with the professional knee brace link, all the links he provided me. I don't think it was quite everything he mentioned, but all the links he provided me in his email along with his answer in today's show notes. Now let's talk about repurposing a small off-grid RV solar system now that you've got yourself a wife and a house like a proper grown-ass man.
Hey guys, it's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead, and today I've got a question from John. John says, how can I use grid power to charge the batteries if I don't have enough solar power? I put in an old RV, I put solar in an old RV I bought when I was off grid. I have 5 100 watt panels, 6 lead acid batteries, and a charge controller and inverter. Now that I'm married, we would like to put it on our house to run the refrigerator and freezer. Later, we will add more panels and upgrade the batteries. Is there a charge controller that will automatically switch between inputs if the batteries get low? So your older systems, you know, the things that you typically end up with when you buy a 100-watt solar panel with a charge controller, it's normally going to be what's called a pulse width modulator or PWM charge controller. And that technology kind of got surpassed by the MPPT or maximum power point tracking technology about 15 years ago. So anytime you go to Harbor Freight or off of Amazon, get like the 100-watt panel with the charge controller and all that, it's just a less efficient charge controller, and it does not have the ability to work with any AC inputs. So there's probably, and I could be wrong, this is an assumption, but there's probably an AC system in the RV that you have. So one of the things that I would look for is, can I just plug that RV in? Is it set up so that it will run off of shore power? Okay. I would just see if I could plug that in and then utilize the AC wiring in the unit. Now, if the RV does not have any AC, if everything is like 12-volt lights, 12-volt appliances, and so on, then what I would do is I would probably get a 12-volt just regular plug-in battery charger, and I would get one that's probably a little higher end than the kind you just kind of sit on your battery in the winter for your car. And I would just run an extension cord out there and plug that in and hook it to the batteries. Okay, that's going to keep your 12-volt battery system topped up. And then it's going to provide, you know, obviously that 12-volt power for the RV itself. Again, I think that you might have shore power hookup on the RV where you've got the 12 or the 120 volt wiring. And a lot of these RVs actually have like a fridge in there that will run off of 12 or 120 volt. So take a look at that. A lot of times there's also a converter there, which will actually create 12 volt power for the 12 volt appliances utilizing 120 volt input. And if that works, you could actually hook that to your batteries, and then the regular kind of shore power plug would also keep those batteries topped up. But what I would say is, if you've got a system that's been kind of sitting for a long time, you should probably look at equalizing that battery bank. Your standard cheap PWM charge controllers are not going to have an equalization function. And so I won't go into that. That's going to be kind of an in-depth deal to discuss on a 6-minute segment here. But look up how to equalize that battery bank and get some heavy juice running through there. Get that battery bank equalized. That's going to extend the life, as well as it's going to increase the amount of power that you can actually store. If you don't equalize a flooded lead acid battery bank, and let's say you've got one cell out of all those batteries that is 70% covered up with sulfation built up, and you can only charge that up about 30%, that's actually going to reduce the amount of charging you can get into the rest of that battery bank by 70% as well. So running an equalization charger, you're literally burning that stuff off, and cleaning those lead plates up in the battery bank is going to, you know, really, really increase the amount of power that you can store in that battery bank as well. And so it might be a thing where you're just charging that battery bank up once a week instead of once a day, something like that. So hope that helps you out, John. Just look for a standard off-the-shelf 12-volt battery charger and run an extension cord out there if you don't have the option to hook right into grid power.
In other words, a lot of times the best solution is the simplest solution with plug-and-play off-the-shelf stuff. Anyway, let's move on and talk about something called the Life Vac. Is it a gimmick to get money from preppers and first aid minded people, or is it something that maybe we really should consider adding to our medical kit? Let's hear from Doc Bones on that.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning 4th edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. This week's question for the Expert Council comes from Zeb, who writes, could Dr. Bones review the LifeVac rescue suction device and whether it's something to keep in our med kits or around the house that would be effective? Thank you, Zeb. Zeb, our Survival Medicine Handbook has a section on CPR, but standard CPR for cardiac arrest and some things like that would probably save few lives in off-grid long-term survival scenarios. One situation where CPR is still of use, even in primitive settings, is with airway obstruction. Most of us know about the Heimlich maneuver, and some have even used it to save a life. The LifeVac unit itself is one of a small number of airway deobstructors that are on the market today, probably the best known one, with the most scientific data available. It's a suction device that differs from the Heimlich maneuver in that you're using external suction with the LifeVac as opposed to air and pressure from below with the Heimlich. It was developed by an entrepreneur named Lee, L-I-H, and a Dr. Lisa Lee Brody, spelled the same way, whom I'm assuming, but I'm not sure, is probably his wife. The story goes that he heard of a woman in the hospital that was weeping following the death of her young son. The reason for his death was a grape had become lodged in his windpipe, and the Heimlich maneuver did not work. Once Mr. Lee heard of the story, he set out to invent an apparatus that could clear an airway, and the LifeVac is the result. Now, I have one in my hands right now as I'm recording this, and looking at it, it's a simple device with an accordion-like suction area, a handle, and two masks, one for adults and one for children that would be, say, maybe a year or so older. The paperwork says it can be used on those 22 pounds or greater. A demonstration at the website at lifevac.net reveals the device to be relatively simple to use. Training videos that also cover CPR are available for sale at the website. The LifeVac has been registered with the Food and Drug Administration as a medical device, but it does not currently have its approval, probably because it's difficult to put together a study that causes life-threatening choking in experimental human subjects to see if it works. Now, there aren't animal studies either, which I guess would have to be on primates to have a facial shape that the LifeVac could accommodate, but there are a number of mannequin and cadaver studies that show good results in removing varying sizes of foreign objects from the throat. A study published in the American Journal of Gastroenterology by the inventors, I have to say, claim a 470 out of 500 success rate on the first attempt and 500 out of 500 success rate after up to 3 attempts. It's an interesting tangent here that it's possible that the LifeVac might have saved the person that donated their body to science when I was an anatomy student in medical school, as I found a big hunk of what seemed to be a peanut butter sandwich in that person's throat. LifeVac claims to have saved more than 2,000 lives, and their website has testimonials from parents, paramedics, and others as to their effectiveness on patients and loved ones. Compared to another device called the D-Choker, it seems to be more effective and have less complications, although a little more expensive. I would think that there'd be few contraindications to using it, but cervical spine trauma comes to mind. The company graciously offers a free replacement mask to anyone who has used the LifeVac in a life-saving situation, probably in exchange for a testimonial. Given that you're saving a life, the list price of $79 on Amazon, well, seems pretty reasonable. So Zeb, you should probably try the Heimlich first while you're having someone break out the LifeVac. I have a LifeVac in my home and take it with me on trips around the country. I think it's a worthwhile option for specific situations in good times or bad. This is Joe Halden, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about over 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning 4th edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
So here's my addition on this. When I heard about this, my first thought was, you know, that's probably a good thing to have in places like restaurants, cafeterias, and schools in general, where there's a lot of people, and you can generally expect that very few of them actually know what the hell they're doing to save a life. That things like Heimlich maneuver and CPR and compressions, and there's ways to deal with this problem. And when I was in school, honestly, in 7th grade health class, we had a full-on first aid course that was part of it that included CPR certification, learning how to do the Heimlich maneuver, learning how to do like an airway sweep, all of that. When I was in seventh grade in a shitty school in Jacksonville, Florida, we learned all that. But they don't do that today. So I think that this very well could be a life-saving device in those areas where you have, you know, like them in a case on the wall, in the hallways, in the case, where somebody can run and grab it, right? And if somebody else knows what to do, then they do that, but at least you have it. I think about this, though, from a standpoint of the average person in their home. What are you going to do, put one in every room or whatever? Like Bones kind of said toward the end, it might be a good thing to have, but you probably should know how to... go get the thing, and I'm going to try to fix it before you get here with it. Like, because when people are choking, they actually have less time than if they were just holding their breath. Because their blood pressure spikes, fear kicks in, adrenaline, everything else, and they actually can end up passing out quicker when they've been choking for 30, 40 seconds. That feels like an hour when you're the one that thinks you're going to die. And the amped up nature of the human being can actually make something that's bad even worse than it is. And so you want to clear that airway as quickly as you can. And I could just see somebody like run, wait, honey, I'm going to run upstairs and get the thing. Well, you could have already done what needed to be done. So if you really think this is a thing that you might rely on, I would keep it where it most likely would need to be used. So I wouldn't keep it upstairs with the rest of your first aid shit. It would be somewhere, you know, adjacent to where you eat, because that's when this is most likely to become a problem. And I do think, based on just looking at it and thinking about it, it probably works. I also think it must have a profit margin of about 98%, because it's really a cheap face mask with a plunger on it, for lack of a better term. That'll valve so that it's pulling out but not pushing in. That's all that it really is. I believe these probably could be made and probably are made for under $1 a unit, probably delivered for two. So, you know, if you're the only person that makes a thing, then you can charge whatever the market will bear for it, and you don't have any competition against you to push it down. Anyway, moving on. I almost skipped over this one. Jeff Lawton is going to talk to you about bindweed, which can be a real problem.
Hi, Jeff Lawton here, coming to you from Jordan, Dead Sea Valley, right next to the Palestine border. So, we have someone's in battle with bindweed, and they're west of the Cascades, so they're in a pretty wet climate, and they're asking about bindweed. They've taken on a property and a bit of bindweed there, and it's starting to move about. Righto, talk about no dig, and also talking about no dig, let's get this straight. You've got to do a lot of digging to get things shaped up to start with. So if you've got gardens, you want to put raised bed gardens in that damp climate. We've got a lot of moisture, because that's the best way to go. It's more advantage over the time. So get all the digging done to start with, and that means you can do a rotary hoe and disfavor that bindweed to start with, so you can get over it and weed it pretty well. So you're saying you're having trouble weeding it, and it's a bit of an issue. In a garden, all we've got to do is keep raising the fertility. So what I would normally do is I would dig, and I would rotary hoe, and I'd get all the beds shaped up, and then I'd get a lot of compost on there, because you want the fertility to be very residual. Because if you increase the fertility, you'll decrease the bindweed. It's there because you have some infertility or imbalances with minerals or general structural conditions. That's what all weeds are about. They take up the advantage to increase carbon pathways rapidly without any sophistication. And we just get annoyed with the sophistication and not the job they're doing. So get all your shaping done, disadvantage it with a rotary hoe and clean run at it, and then go for it with lots of compost and lots of natural fertilizer. You could even cover crop it really densely with four times the density recommended. So you get massive amounts of favorable, fast-growing cover crop on there. Then cut that. Don't dig out the roots. Leave the roots to become compost corridors in the soil. Drop all the top. Put a load of more compost on there and deep mulch. And keep doing that as you raise the fertility and raise the organic matter content in the garden. And it will become less and less of a problem. And of course, in amongst vegetables, you'll have to fine mulch it with your hori hori or your deep like trowel or something, and keep disadvantaging it. But always, always keep increasing the organic matter and soil fertility of your gardens. And that favors your vegetable crop, your herbs and your vegetables, be they annual or perennial. You're just bringing up the sophisticated carbon pathways and disadvantaging the unsophisticated fast carbon pathways, which are your weeds. Now, over a large area, then you're not in a vegetable garden, you're in a broader area, and you're going out over a larger area. If it's a main crop, you could shape, of course, and rotary hoe to start it off, and it's more or less the same thing over a larger area. But if you're going into fruit trees, if you're going into other, you know, long-term perennial tree systems, then you want to go for a perennial ground cover that is going to smother the bindweed. It's all a matter of a race, a spatial race with the weeds. So you can get all kinds of radical ground covers that are going to cover that ground. You could start off with annuals, and then when they've done their cycle, switch into perennials and favor the perennials. Put really favored plant in holes for perennial ground covers. Like, get a really nice hole together, planting hole that's deep enough that it's got like 6 inches of compost and it's favored mulch on the top, and really like put your effort into favoring a load of cuttings there. Now, if you've got fruit trees, that can be on the edge of your compost mulched drip line of your fruit tree that you're planting, because that's what you need to do with fruit trees. You need to have a really spoilt position. Once you planted your tree, put loads of compost down, loads of mulch, even paper and cardboard on top of the compost, and then mulch, but then slip lots of perennial ground covers all the way around the fringe of that so that they grow away from the tree and smother the ground. If you have that every 2 to 3 meters, like three yards or 10 feet, 12 feet apart, if you have a really spoilt planting position for perennial ground covers, or even closer, you can never be too close, you get a complete smother of the ground with perennials, and they'll actually outcompete the bindweed. So you've won the spatial race with the plant that's trying to give you a fast carbon pathway for the condition you're in. You've jumped it out of that condition into a new condition. It's all about positioning the elements that you do want and disfavoring the ones you don't. But that often means changing a condition to your favored plant. Nothing wrong with that, because you want to be in a favored position, because we're creating a productive ecosystem assembly for your advantage. There you go. Get in there and go for it.
So bindweed is really wild morning glory, and it is one of the more difficult noxious weeds to get rid of. Everything Jeff said will work. I will tell you that upping fertility will eventually get rid of this, but you really, 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 really have to up fertility to have the impact of getting rid of it. The other thing is, you need to be careful with the tillage he's recommending. I'm not being anti-tillage here. I am a no-till person, but I have no problem with what I would refer to as establishment tilling. In other words, I'm going to till this place to make a sea change in what's going on here, and then I'm not going to till it anymore. I am okay with that. The problem with bindweed is it's not just roots, it's got rhizomes. And it's a lot like comfrey in that you can take a little tiny piece and stick it in the ground and reestablish it. So the problem with tillage by itself, and note that Jeff did not only recommend tillage, but tillage by itself, is you can actually multiply it. You can multiply it. So there is like an addition I might give. If I had an area with a lot of bindweed already established and I was going to put a garden in, the first thing I would say to myself is, self, do I really want to put my garden where the bindweed is? Okay? Like, but you might be like, this is the place that I really have for the garden. This is the right place for the garden, and the bindweed's here, and maybe the bindweed's there because this is the right place for the garden because of solar exposure. So, okay, fine. You might want to do kind of the tillage thing in the footprint of the garden and a bit beyond the garden. But then what I would personally do is I would make up a quadruple drenching batch of compost extract from some really good biologically active compost with lots of fungal and bacterial activity, and I would slowly spray and drench the area tip to tip. I would then put a completely opaque tarp over it, weighted flat to the ground, and leave it for several weeks to possibly longer. And if I really wanted to up the ante, I would go get a bag or two of, like, you could just, because chicken feet's not that expensive, but like a couple bags of chicken feet, depending on the area, and spread it out. But a lot of times if you go to your local feed stores, you're not going to get this because it's just not honest about it at places like Tractor Supply and whatever, you know. But you go to your local feed stores a lot of times, and say, do you have any old feed or some feed that got knocked open or feed's got some weevils or something in it? A lot of times they'll sell it to you for like a third to a half price. And spread that out along with maybe some dry molasses. This is good soil improvement anyway. And that heavy drenching of bioactive compost, and then dark it all out for at least 2 to 3 weeks. What's going to happen is you're going to have a bacterial, fungal, and microarthropod, worm explosion at the same time you're blowing up because of the compost extract, your bacterial and fungal activity, and you're going to rot the rhizomes. It's not about just killing the top growth. If you take an approach like that, you're creating an environment conducive to rot. And when you pull that tarp up 3 weeks later, you're going to see some of the prettiest soil you've ever seen, no matter what you started with. If you're going to do raised beds anyway, it's not as important maybe, but you're going to really lay the smack down on. The other thing I would do, if I'm going to put a raised bed into a place that had bindweed or any noxious weeds in it, and my own personal main garden, I wish I would have done this because I have a Bermuda grass invasion problem, which is actually harder to get rid of than bindweed, by the way. I would lay down then weed blocker at least 1 foot beyond the edges of where your raised bed stops. And I would mulch over with that with a long-lasting wood mulch like cedar, which will be good for some other things as well. I don't like cedar mulch in the garden, but I don't mind it at all around raised beds. And by the time that cedar, you know, rots away over a couple seasons, and maybe you decide you don't really need the weed blocker anymore, so you cut it around the edge of your beds and pull it up and let stuff grow back in. That bindweed's done gone. It just doesn't have any way now to get up a head of steam anymore. That would be how I would approach this. Jeff's way may work, but it also depends on how much of it you have and your overall climate type and a bunch of other things. But at minimum, I would, once I knock this stuff back, I would heavily, like, the compost is good, but the compost extract initial application, before you even compost on top of it, getting that fungal and bacterial population way up to help break down, consume, and eat that stuff, basically. Moving on, we got one more before my segment. This one is going to be from Nick Ferguson on feeding willow to rabbits.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson from Homegrown Liberty and RarePlantStore.com here with an expert counsel answer for Charles on willow as rabbit feed. I was going through some old questions that I never had the chance to get around to because frankly, I had too many on my docket, so this is an old one. Question for Nick Ferguson. Can too much willow fodder be harmful to rabbits? I ran across someone selling willow leaves as a treat for rabbits. They had the following disclaimer. Willow contains some levels of salicylin or whatever, a natural pain reliever that is the active ingredient in aspirin and sage should not be mixed. Please do not feed your bunny willow while they're on Medicam or another pain reliever medication, mixing NSAIDs, blah, 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 blah. Further, like all snacks and treats, willow should be fed in moderation rather than as a staple diet item. Is this something I should be worried about when feeding hybrid willow leaves to my rabbits? Is it possible to raise rabbits 100% on hybrid willow leaves? Yes, willow has salicylin. Depending on the species, it'll have a decent amount in white willow, less so in black, and I think even less so in hybrids. There's just no really good data on that that I know of. If anyone does have any good data on that, please send me an email because I'd love to see a white paper on that. So my hypothesis is based on the rate of growth. Hybrid willow will have far less in its tissues than the other native species, but that's just conjecture. So take that with a grain of salt. I've never tried feeding willow exclusively, but I do intend to do that experiment in the future. The reason is, you know, I've just always fed a varied diet to all of my animals For the rabbits, they get a smorgasbord of all the fodder trees that I have available, as well as some comfrey, other forbs, grasses, weeds, veggies, whatever else I can come up with, including pellet feed and hay. The fact is, you know, it's just not a good idea to feed one type of food to any animal, just like it's not good for an ecosystem to monocrop. So I have read in different places that you can feed exclusively willow to your rabbits, and they're just fine with them. I've never tried it, so I can't say 100%, but I don't think it's a good idea just because it's just not good to feed only one type of thing to any kind of critter, especially when it's a kind of animal that is bred or designed or evolved, whatever you want to call it, for millennia to eat a varied diet. You know, I just don't see how that makes any sense. So the short answer is, I wouldn't stress about it. Feed your rabbits a varied diet, include willow in there, get a bunch of fodder species that work for them, and have a little bit of everything in the mix every day. And, you know, even go with seasonal additions. Give them some extra carbs in the fall heading into winter to put some fat on. And for those of you who might have missed out on the tree sale, I'm back from SRF, and all my early orders have been fulfilled. And now I have the end-of-year clearance for the last handful of tree packs on clearance at 40% off. I am tired of planting trees, so you guys take them. Thanks for the great question. I hope everyone has a productive spring and a great year. I'm Nick Ferguson from RarePlantStore.com and Homegrown Liberty. Do good things.
Well, good advice from Nick. And the sale he's got priced right now, he's got on his trees. If you want to up your tree planting, go take advantage of it. It's he has good pricing every year. Most years he sells out. He's got some leftover plants this year, and I would take advantage of this. He has some tremendous stuff that you can get at a really great price, rareplantstore.com. With that, let's go ahead and talk about my subject today, which, again, I was asked about winter squash. And this is from John in NorCal. He says, what are some quick ways to cook winter squash? We've largely shifted our dinner starch cravings with a small serving of winter squash a few times a week. Our favorite method is to grill medallions from the neck of butternut. Okay. Of course, these take significantly longer than it takes to grill medium-rare lamb chop. Yeah. Any ideas on the speedy side so my wife doesn't reach for a bag of microwave rice when the squash is still hard? So here's what I'll say. If you want to do grilled or roasted squash and you want to speed things up, take a page from the Minute Rice book. So, you know, Minute Rice is basically rice that's almost all the way cooked and then dried out. So you don't need to dry out the squash. So all you really need to do is go ahead in advance, maybe a month or two's worth at a time, go ahead and cut up your squash into the size that you want to grill or roast. Get yourself either a steamer basket or a dedicated vegetable steamer or something like that. Throw it in there. Figure out how long you need to steam it to cook it all the way to where it would be fork tender and you'd eat it, and then cook it for about 60% of that time. At the end of that 60% of time, take it and break it up into pieces that would equal a serving size for you and your wife, so enough for two people. Throw it in a Ziploc bag, push the air out of it, and throw it in the freezer is an okay way. If you have a vacuum sealer or a chamber vac, go ahead and vacuum seal it. Now, if you've cooked it too much and you do that, you're going to make squash mash. So if you feel that maybe you're going to have, you know, if the first one you do, it gets a little bit of a collapse and you're not happy with it, throw it all in the bags. Throw the bags in the freezer for, you know, 30 minutes or so, maybe 40, 50 minutes, right? And then go ahead, pull them out when they're kind of hardened up and go ahead and vacuum seal them so they'll last a long time. And this way you can make up months worth of, and you can use different squashes to do this. And that's just super easy. Then you, when you bring them out, don't season them really anything. Now, you might want to do a little salt on them, but basically I'd salt, pepper, season as you see fit, and then go ahead and grill or roast, and you're going to get all the flavor you could possibly want. And since you've left some cooking to be done, you're going to develop those flavors in a roasted squash that, or a grilled squash that you don't get if you just do a steam. So that, now, you could also put a whole shitload of it in the oven, even if you like to grill it. go ahead and roast it in the oven until it's almost done and do the same thing. Now, this is important. Do not vacuum seal and definitely don't chamber vac seal things that are hot. The boiling temperature is much lower in a vacuum than it is, you know, in a non-vacuum state, and the moisture in there will boil. And the first time I ever used my chamber vac this way by accident, because I tried to, because a chamber vac you can do, you know, soups and stuff. I tried to do a soup that was probably still at about 120 degrees, and it boiled while it was a mess. Right, so just think about that. There are some other things you can do. Now, this won't give you the form of the squash that you're looking for. But if you use a mandolin, or you use you can even use it like a box style coarse cheese grater to make something more almost like a hash brown, but it will never fry into a patty like a hash brown. I've tried it. It just doesn't work. Or something like a julienne peeler. The one I recommend is made by a company called Conrican, and it's French made. It's not very expensive, but it's a great tool. Or there's another one that really is beautiful for trombuccino because you have that long, round neck, so it works perfect, and that's my favorite squash to grow. With a butternut, you'd have to more cut that big, thick neck into sticks. It's called the Vegetti Spiral Slicer. And basically, you're making some version thereof of what we would call zoodles. Squash noodles, they call them zoodles. Zucchini noodles, zoodles, right? And you can do this with winter squashes as well. Anything like that breaks the squash down into thinner pieces. If you make zoodles out of butternut, you can cook it in a pan with some butter and garlic and salt in all of about 4 minutes. It'll be done and tender to the fork. So now you've got, instead of a roasted squash side dish or a grilled squash side dish, you've got more like a squash noodle. It pretty much will taste the same. It'll eat like noodles, which is nice. And a brown butter sage on a winter squash zoodle is about as perfect as it gets. Another option here, and this really isn't so much a direct replacement, because the zoodles to me are very similar to what you're doing now, but winter squashes make amazing soups. And depending on what other things you put in it, they can be relatively low carb or quite a bit higher, but, you know, it's not like maybe something you're going to eat as a main dish or eat every day or something. Like a good squash, apple, and onion soup with some bacon is a hell of a side dish. And I have an old video that when David Siegler and I were doing Biltong for Breakfast, a little cooking show that never really made it because he started going on the road again, and we just didn't have time to do it anymore. But I did like a standalone, and it's got like music in the background, and it just kind of shows you the process of making a squash soup. And then... When I did that video, I was still using a Vitamix, like a blender basically, to bring everything together into soup form at the end of the cooking process. And that can be kind of dangerous because it's extremely hot. I have since switched to an immersion blender, and I have a 4-in-1 immersion blender that I recommend. And I looked that up so that I could add it to the show notes today along with the Vegetti and the julienne peeler. And it turns out it's like on one of these like limited time special deal of the day things for like $23, and it's normally like $38 or something like that. So just worked out that way. I guess I don't have a price alert on it, or I would have caught that because I didn't see anything come in today on that. But squash soup would be another really great thing. But a big thing is simply just going into a thinner profile. The reason it takes so dadgone long to cook that stuff on the grill is because it's thick and it's very dense. So again, simply by doing a par cook in advance. Now, the other thing about this, it's not cooked at all, and if you throw it on there ice cold, out, you know, barely out of the freezer, barely defrosted, well, it's still going to take longer than you'd like to cook. So make sure on any day that you're going to use it, open up your packaging, set it on like a cooling rack or something like that, and let it sit out at room temperature for a couple hours. You know, take it, if you're going to cook when you get home from work, you know, maybe it's in the refrigerator all day, and then take it out. I'll also throw a little kitchen trick out there for you, okay? Now, I'm a big believer in, like, salting my steak a good 30 minutes to an hour before I'm going to cook it and letting it sit out. Now, I'm going to bust a myth at the same time I give you a hack, all right? The myth is, if I leave my steak sit out for like half an hour before I put it on the grill or in the skillet, it'll come up to room temperature and it'll sear better. It won't be so ice cold when I put it on the grill. It's all horseshit. It's all horseshit. I have, and I've recommended these things for a lot of things, a laser thermometer from E-Tech City. And if you take a steak out of the refrigerator and take the surface temperature, it's going to be around 36, 37 degrees. If you let it sit at room temperature for an hour, it will not come up in temperature more than a degree or two. So it's a myth. It doesn't work. But yet there might be reasons to leave things out for a while before you cook them other than that. Okay? And the squash, like I said, you know, you leave squash out for an hour, it's going to come up some in temperature. It doesn't act the same as meat. But you don't want, like, flies get in the house and stuff gets on your food and stuff. If you're not using the oven, just throw it in the oven. Just don't forget about it. Or if you have something, same type of thing, where you need to leave it out for a while before you cook it, but you don't want, you know, a fly landing on it. You don't want the dog pulling it off the countertop or whatever. Put it in the microwave. Don't turn it on. Just put it, don't forget you did it, but just stick it in the microwave. Those are two places that I often put food that I don't want in the refrigerator, but I'm not quite ready to cook yet. So it's just a little add-on there. All right, with that, let's wrap things up. I hope you enjoyed that segment there. I like talking about cooking. I probably should do some shows on cooking soon, because I haven't really dug into that. But winter squash is a great alternative to a lot of the heavy starches that we have too much of in our diet. Again, there is some sugars and some carbohydrate, because they are the same thing, and winter squash is like butternut, but it is far lower than a lot of things that we would eat in its place, like rice and other things like that, and, you know, huge amounts of bread and what have you. So with that, let's go ahead and wrap up. Let me remind you guys real quick, if you like the show and the work that we do, you can help us out by doing your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. tspaz.com, that way where you can find all my Amazon reviews, and as of recently, all my reviews from Vivor, who has been great in working with me and sent me a large variety of things. I'm hoping this weekend to film a video for you guys. The latest thing that Vivor sent me, it's a chamber vacuum machine, and I have a really expensive one made by a company called Vacmaster, and you guys know me, I'm a big believer in buy once, cry once, and so when I bought the one that I have, I did a ton of research, and I spent about as much money as you're going to spend on one of these things without buying something that you roll around on wheels or you keep in a commercial warehouse. Like, it's kind of that borderline right between true commercial and consumer level. And it's been great, and I have no complaints about it, but it was about $1,600 bucks. I don't remember. It was over $1,000. And I've been wanting one to recommend, and I'm not going to do it yet because I haven't tested it yet. But the reviews I've read and videos I've watched, I expect to be impressed with this thing. And it's under $500. And so I think I'll have that for you next week. What I have for you today is the garden bench that I had yesterday. And this thing is fantastic. When I first got it, I said this is really nice to have. After using it for a month, I'm like, if you're a gardener, especially if you get a little bit older, you care about your back and your knees, get one of these things. They're like 30-something bucks, and I think they're worth at least twice as much. I really love it, and it's made my planting and my maintenance just so much more enjoyable. And here's the thing. We in the prepper space have this, oh, I'm tough. I don't need that thing. You know what? When things are comfortable and enjoyable, do you know what you do? You do them more frequently. And if you, like, weed your garden, maintain your garden, plant in your garden more frequently, you get a more productive garden. So it's not just a thing to make your life easier. It's a thing to make your production better over time. And, you know, a 1% increase in efficiency per week, let's say, over a year is a huge increase in efficiency. With that, I will have a Friday flashback for you tomorrow, and I'll catch you next week. We'll do it all again.
Are they gonna bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. You don't have to live the way they tell you to. Revolution.